Hi. Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here. So I'm going to be talking about the duality between scattering amplitude and Wilson loop. So let me review some background. It's a duality in n equals 4 between objects that look like that, the scattering amplitude for unshelled particle, and the expectation value of some polygonal Wilson loops, which I'm going to describe. And let me, so the duality started at strong coupling as a T-duality. I think it's fair to say that if we're not from the strong coupling intuition, there would have been very little motivation to try look for such a duality. So it started as T-duality at strong coupling, and it's been extensively checked at weak coupling for at least for MHV elicities, in which case you have to calculate the pure bosonic Wilson loop. The one thing which was not clear, well, on Poradio's loop, as we all know, loops know a lot about tree amplitudes. You can cut loops and get trees. So if something is a duality is able to calculate loops for you, it knows it should be able to calculate trees for you somehow. So before I discuss multi-loop amplitudes, as my title suggests, I'm going to discuss how does this duality helps you compute tree amplitudes? How does it allow you to compute tree amplitudes? So what's a dictionary? So on this side of the duality, you have external momenta, which are all null and unshell, and you have elicity data, which is n equals 4, is conveniently packaged into these Grassmann variables. So you're making a series expansion in eta, and that gives you different elicity state for each of the particles. So this is the scattering amplitude side. On the Wilson loop side, this momentum data has to do with the shape of the Wilson loop. So here we're restricting to a planar color ordered amplitude. And in that case, it's possible there's a way to trivialize momentum conservation by writing the PIs as xi minus 1. So the momenta become the length of the null side of this loop. That would be x1, x2, and that would be p2, blah, 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 the length of this side. And supersymmetry is really natural to package the errors into thetas, which are going to trivialize supersymmetry in the same sense that this is trivialized translation, this trivialized momentum conservation. And the thetas are defined such that lambda I eta I is equal to theta I minus theta I minus 1. So now it's a Wilson loop in superspace. And lambda here is the usual lambda which used to decompose the null vector in this way. And in this story today, it will be a little bit useful, but it will be useful to use a certain other way to talk about the thetas, which are this momentum twister formulation. So I start from this data, and I can make a certain object, which is spinor lambda a, and then lambda alpha x alpha alpha dot here, and here I put theta alpha, sorry, lambda alpha, theta alpha, and here. So this is a 4/4 object, and one of the most useful property of this object is that it's acted upon by the conformal group PS2,2/4. Let me just call it SU4/4. So SU4/4 acts like on this, like you would think it would act on a 4/4 object. So that those are very useful variables, and these I call some twister lambda a, alpha a, and a spinner guy a. So this is the how you relate the variables on both sides. And the duality is supposed to be a duality on the where on the left hand side you have a scattering amplitude. It depends on this data. On the right hand side, to make something with the Wilson loop here, there's one thing which you cannot expect to calculate. This scattering amplitude is always proportional to a factor that looks like that. Momentum conservation. Here, if you don't have momentum conservation, the Wilson loop doesn't close, it's not gauge invariant, and you have no clue, it's not defined. So this is a factor you cannot hope to calculate. So let's just write it down. And similarly, there's a factor, there's a Suzy delta function that if it's not obeyed, the Wilson loop doesn't close in theta space, and you don't really have a Wilson loop. So we have to put this in. So we have to strip that off. And, well, while you're there, you might as well strip that factor. Which, so the duality is between MHV strip amplitude and Wilson loop. This is the proposed duality, and this is what was checked at in the MHV case. People found that you have to strip that factor also. Yes?
I'm sorry, this question would probably be appropriate much later, but I can't remember. You mentioned that at strong coupling, T-duality gives you the insight that this should be true. Now, in weak coupling, you're going to convince us by a clever calculation that it is true.
Yeah.
But is there a principle at weak coupling?
It would be great to have a T-duality at the derivation. Have it. It would be, it's clear that there should be something. That's still, this is a missing link.
Okay, well, David Skinner volunteered to answer that during his part.
Oh, yes, okay, good. Yeah, okay. So this Wilson loop in the MHV case, we know we just take the standard bosonic one. So let me write something that's going to be important throughout this talk. I'm going to come back always to it, is that the defining property of this W in general W is that it should be supersymmetry covariant under, it should be covariant under the Suzy. And which Suzy? On the scattering amplitude data depends on the thetas only up to translation. So this Wilson loop has better be translation invariant. Otherwise, it won't even depend on, there won't even be a map between the data. So the Suzy which generates these translations are, let me call them QA alpha. And then there's also going to be this automatically their super partner, which have the same SU4 index, R symmetry index, that are going to be covariant. So this is the defining property of the object. If there's going to be a duality at the for other amplitudes than MHV, then this property has better be true. So I have to come up with an object that satisfies this property. Now, there's a way to construct such an object. If you don't have to be clever, so you start from the bosonic one, and you look at it in one segment at a time. And for one segment at a time, you apply a translation in superspace. So take one segment at a time. And translate into superspace. So what does that mean? So we want this object to be covariant under the SUSY in the sense that lambda era minus, sorry. So if you sum over all particle and do this, that's another right. I want to write that sum over I of lambda I dd chi, so this is what translation is in the superspace. This is the same as sum over I dd theta I. You want this to be equal to q. Put differently, you want an equation that this minus q and wn is equal to 0. So you want to obey an equation like that. And one way to do it is you take this segment and you conjugate it by the generator of translation. So you take x of, so if this is segment 2, my favorite segment, you take x of chi 2, some supersymmetry generator, like this segment, and x of minus chi 2, supersymmetry generator. And here you have to put in some index, some arbitrary choice, and then you put this. Then I invert it here. So if you act on this operator, on this segment, then you've constructed an object which at least works, which obeys the equation at least in the lambda 2 direction. Now, is that enough? So this is the first step. Then you ask, does it work? And so what does this object look like? It starts like, you have dx mu times, let me write dx mu at d alpha alpha dot, you have alpha, let me even write dx, let me write it in the most convenient form. So this you can write as dt times lambda 2, lambda bar 2. So that's going to be the most useful form. And then you have A alpha. So the indices are contracted. So this is the lowest component. To get the component in R in A2, you just act with this guy. And the supersymmetry transformation gives you something like the lambda bar 2 stays along for the ride. You get a psi bar, and then you get a chi 2. And that's it. And the star cancels because the lambda 2 just, the index on the lambda 2 just goes straight into the Q, and this ratio cancels. So the leading term is actually independent of your choice. And from that you will conclude that the whole object is independent of your choice if the SUSYs commuted with each other, you will be done at this stage. So you have an object which is invariant under this Q, and yeah. But it's not quite the case because, as those of you who are familiar with the SUSY algebra, Q and Q commute only up to a gauge transformation. For instance, on A is equal to some d phi. So these things commute only up to gauge transformation. So what this tells you is two things. First of all, this object is not quite invariant, it's not quite independent of star. It's independent up to total derivatives. So
let me call this object the edge depends on star by corner terms. And by the same token, if you act on this object with a supersymmetry not proportional to lambda 2, you find that it's not invariant up to at least a scalar at the corners. So to construct a fully supersymmetric Wilson loop, we have to do this procedure for each segment and then add some stuff at the corners. You follow this procedure. So in the end, you have some edges and vertex terms, which you can construct in such a way that it's supersymmetric. I'm going to give a different characterization in a second. So roughly, but the edge term roughly looks like what it should look like. So there's some d-phi. So you keep going along the Suzy algebra. So, but here in this guy, you have some star, and then two star. And then you have some term with chi 2, d-psi, and then star. The lambda bar 2 never goes away. So as I said, it actually depends on star, starting on the phi term. And then there's some gauge boson term. Then star. These stars are contracted with indices, and the only way they can. And this. So this is the edge term. And then there's some vertex term. And the vertex term, because as I told you, it starts it's there just because of this. It starts from some phi, so the vertex between edge 1 and 2 has some phi 1, some phi chi 1, chi 2, plus star dependent stuff. So let me not talk about this stuff now. So that, and then there are higher order terms, you can keep going. Yes.
Also temple portion to the equation of motion in the commutation?
Yes.
Cues?
Yes.
Not just gauge transforms?
Yes. Yes, gauge transforms and equation of motion. Absolutely. Okay. So that way you construct an object which is a reasonable candidate for this duality. And the thing you do is, well, you try it. It's of course now not how I did that, but you can try this object. I was not that clever. So let's try it that for n image V amplitude. So let's recall what the answer is in image V amplitude for the n image V amplitude. And since we're working on this dual space, the momentum twisted form is the most convenient for us. So it's the expression for an image V-amplitude, tree amplitude, is something like that, the sum over the R invariants, where this R invariant, let me write it down again, is something like, it's a numerator that is A, B, C, D, chi, E, the cyclic fourth. It's like a delta 4 fermionic delta function divided by A, B, C, D, B, C, D, E, A, B, C. So this is the answer. And so you can go on and try to check that component by component. So this is very component form computation, so of course you won't get the whole supersymmetric answer, but let's just check a few components at a time and see if that makes any sense. The simplest component to calculate are those which come from the vertex term, because there's no integral to do or anything. So let's compute the term proportional to chi 1, chi 2, and I know some chi I, chi j, chi I plus 1. For some technical reason, I'm going to take 1 and 2 and I plus 1 to be far apart, so that I don't have any singular graphs or anything. So let me take them to be far apart, like this. if I calculate this Wilson loop, I get only a single Feynman diagram in which I have one propagator like that. And yeah, I actually forgot a little factor of 1, 2 to get the little loop correct. So I have only one Feynman graph. So on this side, I get that the expectation value, the Wilson loop is something like chi1, chi2, chi I plus 1. There's a SU4 index on each of these Grassmann variables. They are contracted in the they are contracted like this, but I'm not going to show this this explicitly in the rest. And downstairs is a propagator, which is 1, 2, I plus 1 times x 1, 2 minus x I plus 1. So this difference square. And this you can write in a slightly more better form as 1, 2, I plus 1. So this is the what you get from this Wilson loop for this component. Now let's look here. If I want to extract component proportional to chi 2, I'm basically freezing I and this sum to be equal to 2. Otherwise, it doesn't depend on chi 2. And similarly, I'm fixing j to be what I call I here. So I only have one R invariant to calculate. 1, 2, 3, I plus 1. And if I extract the component proportional to chi 1, chi 2, chi I, chi plus 1, the chi 1 cancels one propagator, chi 2 cancels another, chi I plus 1 cancels another. The only propagator that's not canceled is 1 over 1, 2, I plus 1, times some chi 1, chi 2, chi I plus 1. So beautiful agreement for this component. And but you can keep going and check other ones that involve these edges. And you can try all of them that are sort of well defined like this, and they all work out. So this looks like it's working. So now let me step back and make some very zeroth order point. So let me make a simple point about the normalization of this. The tree amplitude on this side of the duality, in this equation, what I get there, the coefficient is 1. There's no G Yang middle there. But there, if I do this computation, I actually get the G square Yang mills NC. I'm going to just call it Taft coupling lambda. There's a mismatch of the coupling constant. Here, this was a three-level computation, and here it looked like a one-loop computation. So what you have to do is divide the chi's. You can account for that by rescaling the chi's by lambda to the 1/4. And then this expression, you're putting lambda to the 1/4, lambda to the 1/2, lambda to the 3/4, lambda. And then the coupling constant works out. But then that's even more puzzling because you have inverse power of the coupling. So how do you know the expansion always starts at order 0? And I know at some three-loop thing, you don't get some lambda to the minus 1 in your answer. How do you know that? So this is a very zeroth order puzzle. And the resolution to this puzzle is that you can rescale the fields in the action and absorb the coupling constant in the right way. So I can erase that also. So this superconnection corresponded to the action, which was written as, so this is a standard action, 1 over g square, and f square, some psi bar d psi, there's some phi, and then there's some u kawas. It was a standard action. So. So this expression is to be computed with this action. What you can do is rescale the fields. So let's do a rescaling. So if we take phi bar goes to phi bar lambda 1 quarter, phi goes to phi lambda 3 quarter, phi goes to phi lambda 1 half, then, so I can erase this thing too. That's phi. Then the action becomes, let's postpone a little bit this guy, but for these guys, what you get nicely is that, well, first of all, you've gotten rid of this, and this here, which is why you've done it. But this action then becomes 1 times, so all the kinetic term here, but it's not 1, it's nc. So this kinetic term rescales by a factor of lambda, so we get psi bar d psi, then you get phi d square phi. The two yukawas rescale it a different way. You only have psi bar phi, which is of this order, and so let me stop here. And then you have terms that are order g square and c square that look like this other yukawa and the scalar potential. So it's just done a field rescaling. So, and this action is, So I've just done this field rescaling. And now I don't want to rescale A. A is 1 here and A is a gauge field. I don't want to rescale it. But I'd like to rescale G. This guy here. So the way you do, you follow Chalmers and Siegel, and you introduce a Lagrange multiplier, G. So this was F. So now I'm going to introduce, instead of writing F square, I'm going to write GF plus G square. And this G square is just some auxiliary field. G square is self-dual. The reason it's self-dual is that it's only the self-dual field that I need here. So G alpha beta is self-dual. And you integrate out the self-dual field, you will get the usual F square. But now that's the full action. And these actions are perturbatively equivalent to each other. And this action is good because now there's no power of the coupling anywhere on this expression. So the A has no factor of lambda.
Yes? A useful comment. So this action is actually expanding around the self-dual center.
Exactly.
The MHV expansion action.
Yes, exactly. So what you see is that if you calculate this object to linear and order in the coupling, you drop this term. And you have this action, which is now G is Lagrange multiplier imposing the self-dual equation. And this is a supersymmetric version of the self-dual Lagrangian. So we learned something very basic, is that the three amplitudes are computed by the self-dual sector of this Wilson loop. So the Wilson loop begs you to make this change of variable in which the self-dual Yang-Mills come in. So for the rest of this, let me lay the storyline for the rest of this stuff. The dictionary I want to keep. This I want to keep. This, let me just write the rest of the cast of characters that I want to go through. So far I've introduced what the Wilson loop is. I have shown that it makes contact with self-dual Yangmil. And now I want to discuss the other eye points in this story, which are BCFW and the loop integrand. So now I want to discuss these other two characters. But before I get there, let me just throw something at the audience. So it's just amazing that the self-dual Yangmil is computing trees. The people have been working a lot lately on trying to find ADS duals to weakly coupled field theories. And this is a theory which will be just awesome to have a dual to it. So it's an unless quantum field theory, so you drop this part of the action. It's an unless quantum field theory, there's no coupling constant. You can look at the Feynman rules of this theory, determine it at the one loop. So it's a one loop exact quantum field theory. The Feynman rules look like there's a G, A propagator, and then there's a A G vertex, and you can make one loop but not more with that. And even most important point, all correlation functions in this theory of gauge invariant functions are rational. So let me make this all gauge invariant or of things that look like that involve local operators on null Wilson loop like that. Correlation functions, all gauge invariant, are rational. And this will be made very clear by the twister space formulation that Dave will discuss later on. So it's not your random random theory like 5-4. It's really a nice theory to try to find it would be just awesome to have a dual for it.
That's equal 4 self-dual Yangmils.
Yeah.
So S matrix is 1.
Yeah, there's no S matrix. But the correlation functions are interesting.
Well, that's what's amazing. There are no scattering amplitudes in this theory. Because Wilson loop in this theory computes the scattering amplitudes in full, classical.
I actually wonder if there was a scattering
Not in
four dimensions. I mean,
yes.
Like
in four dimensions?
Right? Yes. Yes, in per Yangmil, yes. Not in the supersymmetric version, of course.
Any possible version?
Sorry? The n equals 4 version?
Oh, no. It's just.
No, it's right.
N equals 4 doesn't have. Yeah, I know n equals 1 doesn't have. N equals 4, I haven't.
Any supersymmetric.
Oh, yeah, right, that's right. It will be out plus. That makes sense. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can you just take the usual ADS 5 and take the limit of n fixed and lambda goes to 0? Just looking at the Lagrangian.
So you want me to take n fixed and g square go to 0? In the ADS theory.
Lambda?
Yeah, lambda goes to 0. Well, yeah, if you need that, yeah. You have to understand a small lambda limit, yeah. Yeah, so this has something to do with the small Taft coupling limit of the. But it's not quite the same. Yeah, I mean, the right does not. I've written perturbatively here because if you want to make sense of this, there are a lot of issues in Minkowski space. Like this GF here doesn't really make sense for a real valued field. In perturbation theory, you don't care. You just use the Feynman rules and so on. But as a path integral, it's not so. Yes. OK, and there's one other thing I want to say about the, before I move on, one last thing I want to say about the Wilson loop is that it actually had, I wish I had known that last fall, but this Wilson loop, it's defining properties that it's covariant under the SUSY. And an object in this property has been discussed in the past. There was one that was constructed by, proposed by Witten in 86, and proved to exist by Ahmad and Schneider in 86. This was a paper on 10-dimensional twister formulation, but in which he proposed this connection. So it's not a new object, because its defining property is this. They have to be the same up to classical equation of motions and gauge transformations. And I've checked that, so hopefully I should put that somewhere else. And then there's one other thing I want to say, is that these connections are much more general because they have theta and theta bars. And so this is just an object in which you take this connection and you put them to zero, you put theta bars to zero. So there's a huge generalization of this Wilson loop that has theta bars and that just exists, waiting there to be explored. So that would be the content of of another talk, maybe next week. But there's this motion, there's this generalization of scattering amplitude which exists, and it's sitting there.
Do you think it gives something else?
Yes, I think it computes anomalies.
What anomalies?
Let's discuss that after. Yeah, it definitely computes something. So now I want to quickly talk about BCF and how. So I given a couple of examples, but what you would like to see at this point is, why does this duality work, or at least do we have a reason why this is going to work for IRK, more complicated tree amplitudes. And so let's see if there's a reason. Why does that work? I cannot answer that to the level of saying, okay, it's T-duality, you take a Fourier transform something and you get this. But there's something you can ask, is something which is very important on the scattering amplitude side, is has been very important in the past few years, is that scattering amplitudes have poles, and these poles are known. Here I get one over p square, and they have these scattering amplitudes factorized on poles. So are you able to see that on the Wilson loop side? In the Wilson loop side, this limit is when two regions become null separated from each other. So you have to study the limit in which two corners become null separated from each other. And the question is, does this factorize into some kind of 1 over p squared times? Do you get a factorization like that in that limit? Times some 1 over p squared. So this is a computation that I did last fall, was to look at this object and this limit. And if you start looking at this connection, you quickly see, well, you all want to do this word computation. But there's one thing you can do, is assume that the object, classically it has a supersymmetry, so assume you can regulate it and all that and do the word computation such that Q and S bar are exact supersymmetries. And again, on the scattering amplitude side, these are exact. There's no reason to believe that they are anomalous. So let's assume that a regularization exists, which is true. These are translations in this superspace. You can use them to put some chi's to zero. Normally, you can use them to put four chi's to zero. But the limit that we're considering, so if this is side 1, 2, I plus 1, the limit that we're considering, this determinant 1, 2, I plus 1, goes to 0. So you cannot put all four of them to 0, because then the determinant of the matrix, which are the linear transformation, which will allow you to do that, is singular. So you can put three of them to 0. Three chi's near the limit you're looking at. So now this is going to be purely bosonic. Same for air, purely bosonic. Same for this guy, purely bosonic. And same for air. Except for air, we're now going to insert some some field G, some dG times chi 4. Then you ask, what is the singularity in that limit? So if you try to do it in the pretty bosonic case, remember this is self Dirac Young Mills, there's no AA propagator. So you don't get anything. But you have an AG propagator, and you look at what the AG propagator does, you have to integrate the AA, the AA. To look at diagrams like that. And you find that there's a pole in this limit, exactly as it has to. Then you look at corrections. So this explains why it works at NMHV, because you have just this diagram. And then look at corrections. We analyze what they are in this limit. So you start from this graph. The pole comes from an integration region where this is very close to this vertex, and this is very close to this vertex. And this Lorentz invariant separation is very small. So you look at correction, it looks like that. And you can imagine correction that will look, say, like a fermion here. So if I start adding some stuff here, I might have a fermion loop here. But you calculate this graph and you find that it's suppressed. It kills the overall divergences, the overall divergence. And the only graph that survives is the other ones in which you have this guy, which couples iconally to these guys. So in this limit, you indeed find that you have a straight, that it factors into a straight Wilson line on the two sides. So it does factor like the pole times. In other words, you just address your propagator by Wilson line and you're done. That gives you the leading term in this limit. So, and then what you do is you invert your Suzy transformation that you used for the chi to zero. You supersymmetrize it back. And then from that, you derive that the poles are exactly what they are from the field theory side. So the factorization properties of this object match those. And as we know, this gives us a recursive way of computing this thing. So the two objects will be the same recursion relation, and they're equal. So yes, there's a mechanism by which this guy is able to calculate all three amplitudes. So now, let me quickly mention on the recent paper by Kotemsky, Sakchev, and Bid.
When the poles are equal, that's of course an important condition, but there's also large Z behavior.
Yes.
What's the argument that there's nothing that happens on the loop?
Yeah, so this is when you take some vertex down to infinity.
Yeah. And you say you study it and you find there's good large Z behavior.
You can use that, or you can simply say that this formulation makes dual conformal invariants manifest. So there's nothing special about infinity. So you can estimate this limit where this vertex goes at infinity if you want, but nothing can happen there because there's nothing at infinity. It's a conformal theory.
To put it another way, you may as well have thought that vertex was at infinity to begin with.
Yeah, so because dual conformal invariant is manifest, you don't really have to work. Let me ask if there are other questions. There's one caveat. So here, to make this deformation, to make this argument, I needed to assume that these SUSYs exist. And you will remember that in the beginning of this talk, I was very careful to just compute graphs which are very widely separated. And if you want to compute the whole thing, you read graphs like this, in which you have to integrate the scalar, there's a divergent endpoint. It's kind of zero over zero-ish. This is not zero over zero-ish, it's one over zero, but every time there's this, I convince myself that there's always a graph like with some fermion that is exactly the same quantum numbers and with a minus sign. There's some zero over zero-ish limit, but you want to be careful and regulate it. And the fact is, presently no good regularization is known. So What I've shown is that you assume that a regularization exists, which allows you to use this argument, then the whole story works out. The fact is, no good regularization is presently known. So in this paper, by Belitsky and Korchensky and Sakachev, they make this point very, very sharp by doing a computation in Belitsky. So they did the computation in. So they propose this. They try one regulator, which was to dimensionally reduce the theory. But not the Wilson loop. So you just took the four-dimensional expression that I've written down, and that, and also one that Mason and Skinner wrote down. They kept it in four dimension, dimensionally reduced the theory, and then the operator explicitly breaks these supersymmetries by d-dimensional equation of motion. So this 2z are obey up to four-dimensional equation of motion. If you take the four-dimensional expression in the d-dimensional theory, it's broken by epsilon terms. So it's just a regulator that badly breaks the theory. And they found that you get garbage if you do that. So all the symmetries are broken in the worst possible way. So let me just comment. There's nothing surprising or new in this phenomenon. There's no good regulator, and it's always the case in quantum field theory that if you use a regulator that breaks a symmetry, you have an object, you regulate it, you break a symmetry, and you don't add symmetry restoring counter terms, and you get garbage. It's always been like that, and end of the story. Let me say it again. In quantum field theory, if you regulate some operator that has some symmetry, you regulate it in a way that breaks the symmetry and don't try to add quantum terms that restore it, you always get garbage that don't respect the symmetry.
What's the precise problem in preserving the symmetry? Because normally, this is a kind of technical score, normally dimensional reduction is quite easy to implement, and it preserves.
Yes, it does preserve the symmetry of the theory. What might work is if you try to dimensionally reduce the Wilson loop also, which they did not try. I don't know. But they kept the Wilson loop in four dimension and dimensionally reduced. So I don't know why that.
Why did they do that?
Well, you should ask them when they come.
Yeah. I understand they use dimensional reduction. Yeah. So what they obtain is some term which has the four-dimensional equations of motion, which is then integrated along the. So some four-dimensional equation of motion integrated along the contour. So what comes out is some sort of p4 squared divided by pv squared. Mm-hmm. So it is 1 plus a mu squared term. So I'm thinking that the mu squared term is there at one loop. Whereas for the amplitude,
things
cancel.
It's a true mu squared, at least, on the Wilson loop side.
I think what you're saying, no one would doubt, is that there is no obstruction.
Let me make a comment. One question you can ask is, does such a regulator exist? A regularization exist? And here's why I believe it's the case. They don't go as far as suggest that it doesn't exist. They definitely don't go as far. And the reason this is that. If you look at all anomalies in quantum field theory, say the Carroll anomaly, so in that case you can always you can ask the question, does a symmetric answer exist? So we can try to calculate this correlation function, You can calculate it very well when x, y, and z are different. This is an unambiguous computation, and you can ask, can you complete this in some way by delta function terms in such a way as to get an invariant answer? And the reason you believe there's an anomaly here is that no answer that is conserved in our currents exists. No answer with a symmetry exists. This case is very different. An answer that has all the symmetries does exist. I think it would be the first example of a case where an answer exists and there's no regulator that computes it. So this is a question you can ask. Does an answer exist? And yes, it does.
But if the answer exists, can you just add the difference?
Yes. And by that's going to be the definition of a good regulator. Depending on your standards, you'll solve the problem.
No, I mean, local way, that's the question of anomaly. If there's no anomaly, then there's a local way.
Mm-hmm. So the best resolution would be just to write down a regularization that works. So that, I imagine that that's going to be how this ends. Okay, so in the last five minutes, let me introduce the last character in this story. So all of this so far was at tree level. Let me introduce now the integrand on this side. So you'll notice something very special about this action is that it begs to be separated as a free part plus an interaction part. So you want to do expansion part of G squared. Well, just expand into number of insertions of that guy. Let me call this interaction Lagrangian. So it begs you to do power series in terms of that guy. So what do you get in the first term? Let's do one loop MHV. So to compute one loop MHV, it's order G squared, you insert one Lagrangian, so you insert some G squared here. And then the diagrams that compute that contributes look like that. And G squared inserted at the point X, and you have to do some before X. So this is a formula. This should be a formula for the one loop correction, order G squared correction to the MHV amplitude. Let's see if it's correct. In this story, it's very important that it's the chiral Lagrangian, but at one loop, it doesn't really matter. So let's just replace this G by F mu nu square. So I'm adding the G tilde part, because it integrates to zero. Let me just do this computation. So if this is x1, x2, then F mu nu of x correlated with this segment. So we calculate this piece of the graph. This computation you can easily do. It's something rational. It's x minus x1 square, x minus x2 square. Then on top there's two indices. The indices are p2 mu, x minus x1 mu, anti-symmetrizing mu and mu. So this is just what this correlation function gives you. There's a pole there, and some numerator that involves this p and the separation. And you could put x1 or x2 here. It's the same expression because x1 and x2 are differed by p2. So this is what you get, reasonable answer. So you square this. What do you get? You get 1 over x1, x minus x1 square. Minus x2 square, so let's add this other segment I, x minus xi square, x minus xi plus 1 square, and you have some numerator, which is p2, x minus x1, let me write it as p2 dot pi, x minus x1 dot x minus xi, and then minus some cross term when you contract the indices in some other way. You have two terms. it's a simple exercise to evaluate this guy, and you can evaluate it, you can put it in a nice form by combining the squares. And what you should find if you do this exercise is that this is proportional to x minus to xi minus x1 square, xi plus 1 minus x2 square, minus 1, 2, divided by the four guys, plus, so what you want to do is basically is put all the x, complete the square and get rid of all the x dependents. So after you complete the, so this numerator is x independent, and all the x dependent piece, you can remove them by completing the square, which is non-trivial, but which in general you cannot do, but in this case you can do, and you get a bunch of triangles. This integral has a name, the Tu-Masisi integral, and this bunch of triangles cancel telescopically because this is antisymmetric in those two points. So this integrand, or the Paris-Haven part of the integrand, is equal to this thing. And this is completely algebraic. I didn't use any symmetrical integration identities or anything. This is purely algebraic. There's no symmetrical integration there. So algebraically, you have this equality. So it was known for, since the work of Gabrielli and others, that this graph and this box integral were related. But this gives you a systematic way of looking at those identities, and it's the way, it's the correct way that generalizes to higher loop. So I think, so it's the correct way to, so this integrand makes a bridge between this picture and the other picture at the loop level. So I think Dave is going to discuss more. So I'm going to end this debate. Thank you.